Hello, everyone, and welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by going to Instagram. You can search Medium Cool Pod on Instagram, and we will pop up. You can also email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Hey, the Facebook and the Twitter slash X is still up, but quite frankly, I don't even check that shit anymore. So you should definitely hit us up on Instagram. I'm just tired of doing shit I don't want to do, really is what it is. This is supposed to be fun. I'm supposed to talk to my movie friends about movies. That's what this is about. Well, we have a lot of that in store because today we're actually going to be kickstarting a new series called The Movie Review, which is where I basically rewatch movies that I've seen before, but I really need an updated opinion because I am of the opinion that whenever, if it's been a while since you have watched a movie that you either love or you hated, or a movie that was really important but you just didn't get, I think it's really important that every 5 or 10 years, give it another view. You know, rewatch it, see where you are in life, see what your lived experiences can do to the film. Yo, I used to think there were a few Bergman movies that were cool, but Ingmar Bergman was just really boring to me. I didn't understand it. Seventh Seal? What? I just didn't understand movies like that. And Wild Strawberries had this cool dream sequence at the beginning. That's pretty much the only reason I like that one. And so, you know, that's where I was. And then, I rewatched those with Matt Soucy a couple years ago. And my God, did I just get it now? You know, it took 15 years probably or something, but I just got it. So I think it's really important that as we grow, a lot of times art can grow with us in different ways, honestly, and it can evolve. And so that's kind of the whole purpose of this series. Not only is it to get you to go back and rewatch some stuff, or maybe watch some really cool stuff for the first time, it gives me a chance to rewatch some stuff. I'm basically forcing all the guests to rewatch these movies going into it for the same purpose, unless they've seen it like super recently. And I know that Sam, who will talk about this, rewatched The Abyss recently. It wasn't that long ago. So he can tell us about that. But so that's kind of where we are right now. And I thought, man, it'd be really fun to rewatch movies that I love too, or movies that I think I'll love even more. You know, so I have a pretty long list. I have a list of guests as well. And I will say this, Joe and I actually recorded two movies. We recorded David Fincher's Seven and Clint Eastwood's Mystic River. But each of those were like 45 minutes to an hour long. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to make this two episodes. So if I reference, you know, the movie Seven or something in the movie Seven during the Mystic River one and vice versa, that's probably why. But just a heads up. So we will be doing, it's already in the can. One of these days I'll be posting the Mystic River movie review for this series with Joe. But next week, we're going to have Sam on, and we're going to talk about The Abyss and Being John Malkovich. But this week, we have a few special things on top of a new series, all right? Not only are we going to talk about David Fincher's Seven from 1995, Joe is actually going to tell us a little bit about his thoughts and feelings regarding Roadhouse, the remake that came out this year. And then I, because we missed the past few weeks, am going to review Love Lies Bleeding. And so that'd be a lot of fun. I'm excited to do that here in a few moments. And just so you know, a few weeks ago, basically a week after our episode 117, I had a guest planned. They fell through. I was really busy. I let that week go. The next week, I have a guest. They fall through. I get a replacement. The replacement falls through. I just don't have time for this shit. So so I pushed that off, right? And finally, I said, you know what? I am going to do the damn schedule that I've been wanting to do since we restarted this thing with the best films of 2023. I'm going to do a schedule. I'm going to get people to shape it up. They're going to watch the movies. We're going to do this, or I'm going to have consequences. You know, so I actually got all of the people that have been on the show, pretty much all the film critics, at least, and not just the guests, but I mean, like, you know, people like Christopher Lloyd with the Film Yap, and of course, Joe. I say that disappointedly, like I don't like him. I love that guy. But the point is, Joe, and then Sam Watermeyer. I have Jake Bottolieri. I have his dad, JB, which, funny enough, they're going to do a show together. I cannot wait for that one. That's going to be fun. I actually, all the way back from like episode 4 or 3 or maybe even 1, I can't remember, but really, really early in the Medium Cool time, I had a guy named Ricardo on. He was the editor for the Bane documentary, Holding These Moments. Sorry, I don't know why I just forgot that I had honor in my head, and that wasn't it, and that didn't help at all. But Holding These Moments, which is still kicking ass in festivals and stuff, by the way, these years later. But Ricardo's going to come on. I've been wanting to have him back for forever. This is the dude that lived in Germany. You know, well, I think he still lives in Germany, but the point is, you know, so we have to, like, you know, work out some tricky time stuff, but he'll be on. So there's a lot going on, and we have a pretty good plan now. And if things go like they do with Joe, where we record two episodes and I'm like, I'm going to make those two episodes, then I'm going to have stuff for a while. Okay. But for the time being, right now, this moment, right now, we're going to go listen to Joe's feelings about the Roadhouse remake.
Okay, everyone, let's talk about the remake of Roadhouse. You can find this on Amazon Prime. It premiered on March 21st of this year. It's directed by Doug Liman. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melchior, Conor McGregor, Billy Magnussen, and Jessica Williams, among other people. This, of course, is the remake of the 1989 film that Patrick Swayze made with Kelly Lynch and Sam Elliott. This is about a loner named Dalton who is the bouncer at a seedy rough and tumble bar. This time, Jake Gyllenhaal plays the character Elwood Dalton, who's a former UFC fighter, and he, of course, becomes the bouncer at this establishment. Here, it's in the Florida Keys, and he needs to clean it up after this local gangster kind of comes in and roughs the place up. Turns out he has some interest in the bar closing down. And, this, of course, is kind of part of the mystery of the film, which is not very mysterious, to tell you the truth. But, this is really just a silly and surprisingly limp film. It does not at all hold up to the original. It's really more of an example of how not to make a new version of these old kind of beloved films. Jake Gyllenhaal kind of just ambles about town and then through the bar. He's sort of waiting for bad guys to come at him. And he just doesn't do a whole lot other than that. He becomes friends with these owners of a local bookstore, which, by the way, is conveniently located next door to the Double Deuce restaurant, which is a little nod to the original film. But the bar itself this time is not called the Double Deuce. It's called the Roadhouse. So he, of course, meets a doctor who patches him up and does not approve of his lifestyle or his tactics in taking out bad guys, but still somehow wants to romance him. So, it just doesn't, their scenes don't really stand up to the ones between Patrick Swayze and Kelly Lynch in the original. They're not as sexy, they're not as cute, they're not just kind of generally as fun. And, of course, it's missing Swayze's presence. Let's just talk about Jake Gyllenhaal a little bit. He, of course, he's a good actor. He's been great in a lot of things, but and here he kind of has his normal little boyish charm. He's kind of one of those hidden badasses who doesn't like to show off his fighting ability until you push him a little bit, and then he's more than happy to throw down. But he has this kind of past as a UFC fighter who has been through some things and has some blemishes in his past life, and he's trying to move on and live a good life, but of course is pulled back into violence as a way of life here. So, he ends up crossing passes with Knox, who's played by Conor McGregor, who of course is a real-life UFC fighter. And he's sort of the inverse of Jake Gyllenhaal, who's sort of coasting through the film. Conor McGregor tries really hard to convince you that he is a fun and charismatic actor. It doesn't really work out for me. He really kind of comes off as someone who's really trying hard to put in a good performance, and it's a bit self-conscious and just doesn't really land. I really found him irritating and not in the way that you should find a bad guy in a film like this irritating. I really just wanted him to not be on screen every moment that he was. I just didn't buy him in. I mean, of course, he's a natural for this role as a tough guy looking to beat up one of the best fighters in cinema history. But he just doesn't he's just not believable as a character delivering lines, and I really just wanted him to go away. So let's talk about those fight scenes, though. There's a handful of scenes that are kind of fun. There's really the first big one between Dalton and the bad guys. That one pretty much works. It's got the right attitude, the right beats, and the right moments. But after that, it just kind of devolves into a messy soup of poor CGI and sort of things that are not really physically possible to happen. There are moments where there are speedboat chases and car chases, and we get Dalton leaping from one speeding boat to another that's going the opposite way. There's a lot of activity on yachts and things that just doesn't seem to fit. And of course, Jake Gyllenhaal's Dalton does not share any of the Eastern Zen philosophies that Swayze's Dalton is studying. He's just not that kind of person. And not that any of this is necessarily bad on its own. It just is also pretty poorly executed throughout. The villain is just not great. Billy Magnussen does a fine job in the role, but the character itself is just sort of a simpering daddy's boy who can't really carry his position in life as well as he wants. He's kind of perpetually losing his grip on reality and on his underlings. And of course, Knox is there to undermine him at every moment. And that's just not, it just isn't all that interesting. Doug Liman really, I'm going to say Doug Liman does a pretty poor job, honestly. His filmography is a bit up and down. Of course, he has films like Swingers and The Bourne Identity, Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise science fiction film from a few years back. But this one is really falls more in line with things like Jumper that just don't really work and don't really exhibit a whole lot of creativity or innovation or anything like that. It's just the here, and once it's gone, it's sort of forgettable. It doesn't really update the source material so much here. It's just kind of borrowing a few key elements so that they can throw the Roadhouse name on there. If you changed Gyllenhaal's character's name, and you know, that this could really just be its own film. So it's just not really as much fun as it could be. It's not as cutesy as it could be. It's not as thrilling as it should be. Not really as clever as it wants to be either. So, if you check out this new film and want to let us know, comment on it, let us know what you think. But this one was a pretty big miss for me.
Shut up, Joe. It's my turn. Fuck off. Anyways, so I'm here to talk about Love Lies Bleeding, which came out this year, directed by Rose Glass, written by Rose Glass and Veronica Tofilska. The cast is Kristen Stewart, Katie O'Brien, our very own Hoosier, Dave Franco, Jenna Malone, and Ed Harris. The release date was March 8th, which was limited, but March 15th for the expanded release. Yes, this is a few weeks ago, but hey, I already told you in the intro what happened, so deal with it, okay? I really wanted to talk about this one, though. In Love Lies Bleeding, viewers are thrust into the tumultuous world of the late 80s in New Mexico, where the lines between love and violence blur in this gritty narrative. At its core, the film follows the intense relationship between Lou, a reclusive gym manager with ties to a crime family, and Jackie, an ambitious bodybuilder. As their romance deepens, they become entangled in a web of danger and deceit, leading to a series of shocking revelations that test the limits of their loyalty and love. With its blend of romance, crime, and raw emotion, Love Lies Bleeding offers a provocative exploration of power, desire, and the consequences of our choices. Now, the characters in Love Lies Bleeding are relatively complex and multidimensional, each grappling with their own desires and demons. Jackie, played with fierce determination by, like I said, fellow Hoosier Katie O'Brien, she embodies strength and vulnerability in equal measure, while Lou, portrayed by Kristen Stewart, is a quiet and captivating enigma. Stewart delivers a standout performance as Lou, bringing depth and nuance to her character's inner turmoil. And O'Brien shines as Jackie, infusing her portrayal with raw emotion and authenticity. The supporting cast also delivers strong performances, adding depth and dimension to the film's ensemble. Most notably for me is Ed Harris, who is wearing a ridiculous but equally awesome wig of a redneck skullet. You know, the long hair on the sides and back, but like bald on top. However you want to talk about that. But director Rose Glass demonstrates a really keen eye for atmosphere in this film, crafting a visually striking movie that is largely captivating. Her bold directorial choices and unique storytelling style elevate Love Lies Bleeding into a haunting and unforgettable cinematic experience. Coming off of her 2019 film Saint Maud, which won the hearts of many, I think Love Lies Bleeding is the superior film of the two. Glass and Tofilska's screenplay for Love Lies Bleeding is nothing short of engaging, blending elements of romance, thriller, and drama. The dialogue is relatively believable, and the evocative beats it occasionally hits drive the narrative forward with intensity and suspense. And this is all brought to life by the cinematography. Love Lies Bleeding is visually stunning to me, with sweeping landscapes and atmospheric lighting creating a sense of unease and tension. And the way that they shoot, using this lighting and the camera work, the way that they shoot New Mexico, it feels like an independent film and it feels small, but at the same time, it has, there's a, I don't want to call it breathtaking, but there is a very atmospheric and big vibe that this movie carries. It just kind of wears it on its shoulders. The use of color and composition adds depth to the texture of the film, enhancing its overall impact, I think. You not only see the film grain, but you can feel it. And I don't know how else to say that. There is a vision behind these choices, too. A vibe, like I said, not too unlike the visuals of something like Ty West's X. Especially the scene where, for some reason I'm forgetting the song. I want to say it's like Don't Fear the Reaper, but I could be wrong. Their song's playing an X, and the dude gets out of the car and is murdered by the old lady, but it's all just stark red lighting. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of vibes like that. Mikkel's Cold in July, which came out, I think, 2014 or something. It's one that I really want to rewatch, too. It's so awesome. But Love Lies Bleeding is really nothing like X as a movie, to be clear. But I was often reminded of Cold in July. And if you have not seen Cold in July, it is a 2014 crime thriller directed by Jim Mikkel, based on the novel of the same name by Joe R. Lansdale. And I'm getting somewhere with this. Bear with me. Set in the 1980s East Texas, the story follows Richard Dane, a small-town family man who shoots and kills an intruder in his home. When the intruder's father, Ben Russell, seeks revenge, Richard becomes embroiled in a web of violence, corruption, and deception. As Richard delves deeper into the mystery surrounding the intruder's death, he uncovers disturbing truths that threaten to unravel his life and sanity. Joined by a private investigator and a hardened ex-convict, Richard navigates a dangerous underworld where nothing is as it seems. Now, the reason I bring up Cold in July and give you that long little synopsis, I guess, is it also carries an 80s-ness on its shoulders. And although it feels like derivative hyperbole, you know, hyperbolic nonsense at first, I think Cold in July offers a really, really fun ride. And it takes you on a trip through a crime story fit as for an 80s gem. And so in the same way, Love Lies Bleeding seems ridiculous at times, over the top in some ways and overly subtle in others, and it can appear to lack nuance. But then you find the nuance later and realize it had been there the whole time. So Glass's film, although it may not be groundbreaking in most ways, you know, it is entertaining at the very least. Now, the areas that it certainly breaks some ground is in the depiction of strength and empowerment. The film explores the concept of physical strength as a form of empowerment, particularly for women. Set against the backdrop of the 1980s bodybuilding scene, it examines the societal expectation of women's bodies and the burgeoning visibility of female bodybuilders. The use of steroids is, you know, portrayed not merely as a means to enhance physicality, but also as a catalyst for unleashing pent-up rage, suggesting a link between, you know, bodily autonomy and the expression of suppressed emotions. The film explores love and crime as themes, and though we can point fingers at many movies that explore these themes, this film in particular, Love Lies Bleeding, does not feel derivative, in my opinion. At its core, the film is an erotic thriller, pretty much, that intertwines love with the criminal underworld. It scrutinizes how these two elements can become deeply entangled, affecting personal relationships and life choices. The narrative follows the protagonists as they navigate their intense romance amidst the shadows of a crime-ridden past, highlighting the sacrifices and loyalty demanded by such a precarious balance. Obsession is a central theme as well, particularly the obsession with power and control. The characters are driven by their desires for success, love, and authority, leading to a series of increasingly intense narrative twists. The film portrays guns and muscles as symbols of power, reflecting the characters' struggles for dominance in their respective spheres. However, contrary to typical portrayals of action heroes, Love Lies Bleeding emphasizes the vulnerability of its protagonists. It presents a realistic depiction, or semi-realistic at least, depiction of violence and its limits, creating characters who are both strong and sympathetic. This approach allows for a more nuanced exploration of the character's strengths and weaknesses, making their journey more relatable and emotionally resonant. Speaking of 80s-ness, Love Lies Bleeding contains an immersive visual artistry that seamlessly blends nostalgia with contemporary flair. Through its distinctive style and aesthetic, the film pays homage to the vibrant culture of the 1980s while crafting a narrative that feels fresh and modern. One standout aspect of the film's production is its meticulously crafted costume design by Olga Mill. Mill's creations capture the essence of the area, or of the era rather, particularly within the realm of female bodybuilding. From flashy spandex to bold patterns, the costumes reflect the violent, romantic, and sensual elements of the film, adding depth to the characters and enhancing the emotional weight of the story. And in addition to its too-cool-for-school costume design, Love Lies Bleeding adopts a pulpy aesthetic that permeates its storytelling and visual presentation. This gritty, raw quality adds intensity to the narrative, drawing viewers deeper into the surreal world of the film. Glass and cinematographer Ben Fordsman masterfully utilize abrasive editing techniques and vibrant colors, notably the nightmarish neon red, to create a visual style that mirrors the heart and brutality of the story. And though the film is not flashy with its special effects, I'd say, it relies more on practical effects than CGI, and the film's visual effects are well executed and add to the overall atmosphere of the story. They are largely seamless and unobtrusive. I think the special effects do exactly what special effects should do, enhance the film's impact and immersive qualities to build its world. Another important aspect of the film's is the film's score, created by Clint Mansell, probably most known for his work with Darren Aronofsky, which is this specific score is haunting and atmospheric, heightening the emotional resonance of key scenes. The sound design is also effective, further immersing viewers in the world of the film and enhancing its overall impact. The pacing is well executed and appropriate. It stays engaging, which is more, you know, than one might say about most new movies, in my opinion. Especially the retro-inspired crime pictures that come out these days. I think this one actually has a really moderate pacing, and it's actually really effective pacing in context. I gave Love Lies Bleeding a 4 out of 5 stars. Though it is not an amazing exhibition of the praise I've given it so far, in a studio system that constantly forces out pictures with little vision, nuance, subtlety, heart, and thoughtful exploration, Love Lies Bleeding stands out like a sore thumb. And in this case, the thumb being sore is a good thing. Love Lies Bleeding is a dark and mesmerizing tale of love, betrayal, and redemption brought to life by a talented cast and visionary director. With its compelling storyline, stunning visuals, and evocative soundtrack, the film offers a haunting exploration of the human condition that is sure to linger in the minds of viewers long after the credits roll. I would never call Love Lies Bleeding a must-see, but I do recommend it as a film you should definitely see this year, and if you can support it in theaters, I think it's well worth the price of admission. I hope Glass and other filmmakers have the motivation and courage to step outside the box and create movies that really showcase the talent of the creators behind them. If you agree or disagree, please let me know by reaching out to Medium Cool on Instagram, Medium Cool Pod, that is, on Instagram, or emailing us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Next up, we talk about David Fincher's Seven. Well, we're back. Joe, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing very well, and I'm even doing better because we're about to take a trip to Bummerville for both of these movies, and it is my home. This is where I like to be. If Matt Soucy were here, he would scold us for watching these two back-to-back.
Yeah.
But you know what? Fuck you, Matt. You can just stay at home for now because I'm watching two Bummer movies. All right? That's right.
Go back and look for your Detroit Tigers and leave us alone.
The first movie that we're going to discuss is Seven from 1995. This is directed by David Fincher, written by Andrew Kevin Walker. The cast is Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Kevin Spacey, the most notable. It was released September 15th for its premiere, but September 22nd, it got its wide release back in 1995. It was a budget of $33 million and made 10 times as much money in the box office, $327 million. If you've never seen, that's not enough. Yeah. At least there's a seven in there. So if you've never seen this, why? Shame on you. This has been around for nearly 30. We're about to make it 30 years next year. Yeah. Come on. However, it is streaming on Max, which even though I own the Blu-ray, I just watched it on Max because it was easier.
Yep, same here.
And this movie is great. It's one of 1995's nominees for Best Film Editing at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. But Fincher 7 is about two detectives, one about to retire, the other newly transferred from upstate New York. And they find themselves on the trail of a serial killer who selects his victims based on the seven deadly sins. As they delve deeper into the investigation, they uncover a series of gruesome murders that lead them down a dark and twisted path. With each new discovery, the detectives are forced to confront their own moral and psychological demons while racing against time to catch the elusive killer before he strikes again. As the tensions mount and the body count rises, the detectives are drawn into a chilling game of cat and mouse that will test their resolve and push them to the brink. Seven is a gripping and suspenseful thriller, or those are my words at least, that will keep audiences on the edge of their seats until the very end. This has been among my favorite films of Fincher, ever. I don't know if it'd be in top 20 quite, but I mean, it'd probably be up there. I love it. But this has been one of my favorites since the first time I saw it. I love every minute of this one. I hadn't seen this in a long time, quite frankly. So that's how I'd felt all the way up to this point. How do I feel now? We'll talk about it, but I want to hear from you first. Yeah. Joe, what say you?
Well, let me answer your question with a question. Is this movie the greatest police procedural thriller film ever made? That's the thing I legitimately asked myself while I was watching this movie. I was just like, my God, this movie is perfect. This movie is so just perfect in every way. There is not a missed beat in this movie. There's not a wasted second. Even in the moments when we're looking at these gruesome crime scenes, which are, you know, extraordinarily distracting, we're learning things about these people as characters, these two guys as characters.
100%.
Yeah. They're talking about things that has nothing to do with the crime scene and the main plot of the film. That's more character work while they are standing over these dead bodies and examining these dead bodies in great detail in just a gripping way. Like this movie, if there had been, you know, a quarter of the dialogue in those scenes, it would still have been just a tremendous film, but it just is packed full of character and plot. Every moment is also driving the plot forward, and just little tidbits that turn out to be big things, moments where you think they're just simply character moments that later on actually become integral to the plot, and a outstanding sort of twist ending, of course, that everybody knows. But yeah, I love this movie. Yeah. I would call it probably, I would,
I don't know. Tell me a better Fincher movie and I'll tell you you're wrong. But, you know, maybe there's one that's as good, but this is just a perfect movie. But sorry, I'm going to do one aside because I knew I needed to do this. My pet peeve of this movie, and I know it says it in the title, but I hate it anyway. I hate when people spell this title with the number 7 in the middle instead of a V, because I hate it. I just hate it, and I refuse to do it. So
you've hated it every time I've texted you to watch
every 7? Every single time. Right now I'm looking at IMDb, S-E-7-E-N. Like, what the hell is that? That's not 7. Is that 7? What the hell is that?
It's the most new metal mid-90s thing that's ever existed. It's like Korn with the K and the backwards K even. You know what I mean? Yes. Or the backwards R, whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but yes. But anyway, yes, let's move on.
No, I mean, you actually, the first thing you said with the question to answer a question, mm-hmm. one of my notes says serial killer thriller, one of the best, question mark. Yep. I have production, writing, music, performances, and David Fincher, mm-hmm. all as headers for notes that I have for this. And guess what word follows all of them? And it's the only note I have for them. Great.
Great.
That's it. Production, colon, great. Writing, great. Like, that's literally my notes, because it was like, I'm just going to wing it because I could say so much about, like, I don't even need notes for some of these things because it's so good. And you just highlighted why. Mm-hmm. And we'll go ahead and start there. I mean, I think the production is absolutely top notch.
Yes.
Every room feels exactly how it should feel. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Anything from and just to clarify, I am aiming to avoid like major spoilers. But if you're listening, you haven't mm-hmm. seen this, you've had 30 years to do it. You may not even have been alive that long, but it's your fault. And then the other thing is, I may have some spoilers in here. I don't plan to spoil the very end twist in case you haven't. It's the same as if we watched The Sixth Sense. I wouldn't ruin the end, even though everyone freaking knows the end. Mm-hmm. But I will say what's in the box, and hopefully you know what that means.
Yeah.
But I actually watched this with my buddy Jordan, and whenever Brad Pitt says, what's in the box, he was like, that's what this movie's from? And I was like, dude, that is this. So, talking about production, everything looks great from the whenever the businessman or the lawyer or whoever gets killed in that kind of really nice huge office that he has, which looks pristine, down to the man that he starved to death for sloth, I believe it was, where that is just completely stripped down and disgusting. You know what I mean? Like, it just, you feel the way it smells in there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's like everything is perfect. There's a great scene in that one where they have the SWAT team with them and they're trying to break in because they think that the killer is in this kind of gross apartment, and it's this sloth murder, right? Or well, you know what I mean. And they kick the door in, and they all stand there, and there are four flashlights shooting in. There's, you can't tell there's smoke in the room, but there's just enough to cause beams.
Yes,
right. What a fucking great shot.
Yes,
you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, it's little things like that I'm watching, and I'm like, this just excites me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this really establishes, and of course, it was a little bit there in Alien 3. Mm-hmm. Someone like Sam might argue more so, but I don't. Yeah. But I think 7's where it really establishes his style, where everything's kind of yellow. And you know what I mean? Like, and he loves flickering lights. And, you know, like all the things that Fight Club really, you know, Fight Club was the final nail, right? But this was where it started, that style. And it feels there are times like the little title cards where it says like Friday and all like that feels so 90s. You know what I mean? Yes, the theme song feels so 90s.
Yeah. But in like Nine Inch Nails. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But in kind of like a timeless way. And that's funny because I'm placing it in time. Yeah. But, you know, like we have period pieces that go to the 50s and you could say, man, it feels so of its time in the 50s, even though it was made in the 2000s, maybe. Sure. That's what I mean by this. It's like, yeah, it was made in the 90s, but it also feels so much of its time in a good way, like not in an aged way, but in like a cool way. And I love that. The writing, you fucking pinpointed it, bro.
Yeah.
Like there's not a wasted moment. And I remember when I was in a screenwriting class in grad school and I kept writing, we were writing spec scripts. So for those who don't know what spec scripts, if you're listening, these are usually the entry level scripts. If you're not a screenwriter, you'll write these, send them off to studios or you have an agent that does this. And then these are your traditional, at page 30, you move on to the second act. You know, at page 60 or whatever, you have that middle, like where you split the part one and two of act two, you know, and it's like everything is almost down to an exact page. You have the rise and it's the most traditional. We've seen it a million times. Good Will Hunting was this. Being John Malkovich is this, even though that's a very bizarre movie. I just rewatched that recently. We'll be talking about that, I believe, next week. But anyways, like there are a lot of spec scripts that are really great and they can be done well, but a lot of times they're real tropey. Now, I say all that to say that's what they wanted us to write. And so I'm failing at this left and right because I keep writing shit that's too different. Like I'm like, I want to make a movie from one person's perspective that, you know, is confronted by an organized crime syndicate and we follow him running away rather than all the other stuff other movies would focus on, which is maybe the organized crime people trying to find him. No. This follows him. And I had just watched the movie Lock with Tom Hardy where he's just in a car the whole time. And that was like an inspiration for me where it's like, I want this to be texts and phone calls and this guy, the tension is in this guy trying to get away. And that's what I wanted. And I got through the first act, turned it in. This isn't going to work. I make another move. I start writing another script because all we had to do was have the first act technically, but they wanted a full script. But first act, I'll get through this quickly, but I'm long winded. So deal with it. So here it is. I write this one story, and it is where the main character is a person that you don't like. Okay, so think of a There Will Be Blood, or think of a Freddy Quill from The Master. I just picked two Paul Thomas Anderson movies, but my point is, you know, you have these movies where someone's kind of a bad guy. I was really into The Sword of Doom, which is a samurai movie where you follow the evil psychopathic samurai, basically not the good guy. And so I was like, man, I want to write something like that. Nope, doesn't work. You got to have a likable character. That's what they kept telling me, right? They were trying to keep me in a box. So you know what I did, Joe? That was all a lead up to this.
Yeah.
I got a copy of the Seven script, decided I was going to do a futuristic sci-fi detective movie. I read the script for every scene in Seven. Mm-hmm. I had a comparable scene in mind. Now, it wasn't a one for one, but I was following its structures, what I'm saying. So, okay, this is a solo shot with Morgan Freeman in his apartment and he starts a metronome. All right, cool. What can my character have that can be in a place that will act as the same, it a function as the same thing, right? So I really did that and I ended up acing it because of this freaking script. You know what I'm saying? And that's my point. Yes, mine was derivative of this, but I don't give a shit about that. The point is this writing is so good. I want to blend the performances in the writing and pass it off to you real quick. The writing we've already established is great, but how do you feel about the performances, the writing, and how those work together? You know, like how does Brad Pitt, how does Morgan Freeman work for you? All of that.
It's close to perfect as it can be. Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt together, just as a duo, they're almost pitch perfect. I will argue a little bit after, you know, just finishing it, that end scene, that what's in the box part, maybe wasn't entirely Brad Pitt's best work. It was a great tense scene and it's, you know, it's iconic and all that. But watching it, I was like, it was a lot of like face acting and scrunching his face, which, I mean, cool and great. And it's like, you know, but, you know, as the umpteenth time I've seen it, I was kind of like, I don't know. But Morgan Freeman in that moment was just perfect. And the line I even wrote on my, you know, in my notes, you know, when he says John Doe has the upper hand, I was like, God damn, what a great line that is. Like, just what a perfect line was that for the, you know, for that moment. And I assume that's the writing. I assume that's not an improvised scene or an improvised line, but just going through the whole movie there, it's just such a great build between the two of them where they dislike each other. And obviously that's a well-worn trope in movies, you know, from Lethal Weapon and, you know, even movies way before that, where the partners, you know, new partners don't get along at first. But, you know, Morgan Freeman is just such an ass for most of this movie. And he's just, you know, he's just so dry and he, you know, he's just like, and he says, people find me, what does he say? Unagreeable.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just works. And Brad Pitt is just, you know, he's the no nonsense. They're both no nonsense in so completely different ways that it just works completely. Number one, you believe they don't like each other. And number two, you believe they also in that weird way kind of get along with each other and really enjoy each other's company. And it's, so it just all works. And the supporting cast, which we haven't even mentioned, the supporting cast, Arlie Ermey, you know, the drill instructor from Full Metal Jacket. There's John C. McGinley from Scrubs, and Point Break is the one I'm going to mention him from, a million movies and TV shows.
But he plays a SWAT guy, which I think is really funny.
Yeah.
Because he's like the least SWAT guy in most things I've seen him in, but he actually pulls it off really well.
Yeah. And he delivers that great line, you know, that "you deserved it." And when before the guy like dead guy breathes, and it's like such a great moment. Again, another like this movie. This is just a movie full of iconic scenes from actors with tremendous performances. People that we know that just blend. I didn't even realize John C. McGinley was really in this movie. You know, watching, at least I wasn't thinking about it watching it this time. Richard Roundtree is also in it, which was kind of fun. And it's just, and of course we haven't mentioned Gwyneth Paltrow that much, but she also is just the right presence, you know, in this movie. So it's great all around, and it all blends together, like you said, from the writing to the people delivering the lines. It's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up Gwyneth Paltrow, and that's exactly where I was going next. It's I love, so first off, as my buddy Jordan and I were watching this, I was like, I actually just never realized how much like Lethal Weapon this is. I was watching it. I'm like, this is like a way better Lethal Weapon. And I like Lethal Weapon, but this is like a billion times better than that movie.
I did think like, what if this, halfway through the movie, I was like, what if this was Lethal Weapon 3?
Dude. Oh my God. By Fincher. Can you imagine? It would be so awesome. Good. It'd be way better than the original. But yeah. But I was thinking like, man, they're so good at not liking each other. But the thing is, like, Morgan Freeman is a like tried and true professional. Mm-hmm. So he's going to work with this dude, but he's going to be legit. And being completely bold like that makes him look like a dick. But in reality, all he's guilty of is just not wanting to befriend this person. Like, that's he's about to retire. He doesn't want to make new relationships. Fuck this guy. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
You know, he's just full of piss and vinegar. He's going to fuck up some shit, like, because he doesn't get it. And I'm just going to mind my own business. Brad Pitt's character, Detective Mills, is the newcomer, wants to prove himself, wants to be the best there is, has tons of optimism, right, that he can make change, whereas Detective Somerset, which is Morgan Freeman's character, has no hope. This is always what it's going to be. Like, it's almost like Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men. It's like, I don't understand the world anymore. Yes. I don't understand how these things happen.
Yeah.
But what I love, going back to Gwyneth Paltrow, is she is like the staple where things change. Mm-hmm. Somerset is an asshole to Mills the whole time. And then whenever he finally is kind of pressured into going to dinner, he and Gwyneth Paltrow's character, I think Tracy's her name, they talk, and it humanizes Mills, right?
Yeah.
But what is so great is whenever Somerset's guard drops, it humanizes Somerset. So now we've humanized our two protagonists in an extremely believable and logical way.
Yes.
God fucking damn it. And this is in like the performance and the writing. This is why I brought those up, because like that is them joined, right? That is where it works.
That's what pulls them together. Yeah.
Yes. And so like that is so good. And then, of course, like by the end, they're still different. They still have conversations where they end up on two different sides. One guy wants to kick the perp's door in. The other guy says, no, this is bad. You know, one person believes it is hopeless and everyone's apathetic. The other person believes, no, there is hope. We can still make a difference. They're still opposite, but it's like they're the yin and the yang, to use a really terrible cliche. But it makes the point, though, right? Like they are what each other needs to balance and find this justice that they seek, right? Yeah. So I really love that. And I also just want to point out that I think the music's great, too. I don't think I've ever really paid attention to music, nor is it necessarily anything I'm going to play when I'm not watching the movie. I don't mean in that way. I just mean it's just really well done. And I was, I I want to say it was the scene where the SWAT team's kicking in the door and they go see the sloth. I want to say it might be there. I can't remember exactly when the music kicked in, but it's all so subtle that it doesn't draw your attention.
Yeah,
but there was one point where the scene was so effective, and I'd seen this movie so many times, it's just been a while, that I was like really dissecting it, like what's making this so good? And I realized, dude, that the music really enhances this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing crazy. Nothing super spectacular. It's not winning any awards. I get it. But it's just back to perfect. Like, it's just, that's why it's production. Great. Writing. Great. Music. Great. Performances. Great. Like, that's what I have. So I want to take a few minutes to talk about a few themes that I pulled out this time, though, because Matthew Soucy said probably the first, I think it was the 2020 best of 2020 thing that we did, I'm pretty sure. First time I ever had Matt on. And or this might have been Bergman, actually. I think this was when he and I did Bergman. Okay. And he was talking about, I encourage people to rewatch movies that they love or that they don't know why they didn't like it, but they didn't like it as much or whatever. Rewatch that every 5 to 10 years, because as you kind of age or you get like more mature or you have different lived experiences, it can cause you to react to art differently, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of mentality changed the way that I rewatched. I already lived that, but I love that I finally had that in my mind where it's like, no, I want to actively do this now. And that's kind of where all of this whole movie review series kind of came into play, because it's like, man, I want to rewatch some of this to try to get it. And so I've seen Seven tons of times, so nothing was a surprise here. However, I was looking for more depth. So all that to say, there were a few notable themes I wanted to touch on real quick. Morality and sin, of course, and kind of adjacent or connected to that is justice and revenge. The human condition, which I'll talk about each of these briefly. Redemption and hopelessness, which we kind of already touched on a little bit, but I'll kind of bring that back. And then the power of evil. These were kind of the things that I pulled. Yeah. And I just want to talk about this, and I'll get your thoughts on it if you have anything to say. If you don't have much, that's fine. But I would love to hear what you think here. So at the heart of Seven, with a seven in the middle, S-E-7-E-N, by the way, is I think at the heart of Seven is kind of an exploration of this morality. And not just sin, but the consequences of sin, obviously. So, you know, the film delves into the nature of good and evil. It's examining, you know, how individuals grapple with their own moral compasses. And quite frankly, the choices that they make in the face of temptation. And I want to talk about temptation because I think temptation can also be like a lack of discipline in this case, or a desire for revenge, which ties into my justice and revenge. But like, for example, when Brad Pitt's Detective Mills kicks in the killer's apartment door after being assaulted by him in the alley, and he abandons like all reason and, quite frankly, justice, because he knows this is going to fuck up everything.
Yeah.
He's been told by Somerset, who I think calls him a son of a bitch or something after, you know. But and he kicks in the door anyways. There's no reason behind it. Well, there is a reason, but I mean, he's not reasoning through it, right? There's no logic. It's impulse. Mm-hmm. And so now it ends up, I mean, it ends up working out because he ends up making this whole thing and he pays someone off to, you know, like the whole, if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But at that moment, he didn't care. It was impulsive, right?
Yeah.
And so like what it made me think of is how morality is really relative. If you think about it, it evolves over time. Think of it this way. You may believe capital punishment's wrong, right? But then think of if Kevin Spacey's killer was real. And someone might actually utter the words, he should be executed. Like, he's too bad, right? Well, that's a morality. That is a cognitive dissonance. You don't believe in this, but you're sending someone to live this fate, right? Another thing that I use often in class, actually, in the classes I teach, is Dexter. You believe murder is wrong, but but he's killing bad guys, though. You know, like, and you support the character of Dexter, the TV character. Like, these are cognitive dissonance things, right? And so whenever I think of this movie, I love exploring. It caused me to kind of explore how they talk about morality. Detective Mills constantly is talking about, like, how fucked up this place is, you know, but he wants to be here and he wants to make a difference. And then in the end, he's fucking up. And quite frankly, in the end, he does some fucked up shit. So it's crazy. And then bringing Justice and Revenge, and then I'll get your thoughts here, is about how the film raises questions about not only justice, but the desire for revenge, which I mentioned earlier, kind of in the face of perceived injustices, right? So you have injustices being, you know, it could be the killer. It could be a whole mess of things in this movie. There's plenty of injustices here. So as the detectives pursue the serial killer, they're forced to confront their own like motivations and ethical boundaries. And it leads them to deeper examination of just like the nature of justice, which I think it leads us as an audience to the nature of justice and its limitations, quite frankly, because I think that's, I mean, really where we kind of end up. So whenever you think of these things, like, do you have anything to add, or do you have you thought about these things whenever like watched it?
Oh, absolutely. And I, there's all of these like juxtapositions, the hypocrisy of what John Doe, the killer, is doing, the hypocrisy of what the police are doing, and how they kind of intertwine is really central to this movie. And, you know, and you mentioned those things that, you know, the revenge, and there's, you know, the like that nature of revenge that John Doe is feels that he's a weapon of God to wreak revenge upon these people who have sinned. And, you know, they point out, Somerset points out toward the end, he's like, yeah, but, you know, you are enjoying this, you know, isn't that a sin in itself? And he's like, sure. You know, it's like, it's like, yeah, I don't care. And it's just like it's that whole thing. And that's the Brad Pitt character also, who is, you know, who is an agent of the law and who's sworn to uphold the law, but will also do things like pay off a crackhead to lie for him, to give him justification to kick in a door. Yeah. And, you know, and he'll, you know, he'll shoot someone, you know, who he's, you know, like in a situation where he shouldn't shoot them. And it's, you know, it's just these things. It's that who is worse, who is better between those two. Those characters are so, you know, they're these mirror images of themselves, right? Like, you know, John Doe is the bad guy, but what he's doing, is it any different than what Mills is doing? Because I would argue maybe not so much. But that's all, you know, that's the big theme of the movie. And the big thing to me, you know, and you know, you talked about those themes, but I think there's one that's, you know, maybe pulling back a little more, is the worldview is what Mills and Somerset represent different versions of. You know, I think Somerset is, you know, being the grizzled old veteran who's seen a million things, like, they're both convinced that like the world is screwed up, right? Like, this is a screwed up world that we live in. And Mills thinks he can change it, but he's going to military his way into that. He's going to take down all the bad guys and make the world better, as a better place, the way that he wants the world to be. You know, this ideal version that he has of what a good society is. And Somerset is kind of that opinion at the, you know, at this point of his life, is that it's like, it's just not happening. Like, that's a pipe dream. Like, the world is too screwed up and I can't handle it anymore. Like, he was like, I was you once, and now I can't handle the thought of you. That's kind of like their conflict between the two of them. And it's just, it's just such a interesting, gripping, you know, it's like, you can't look away from this argument that they have. And it's,
well, they have that, I think this might be the one you're specifically referring to, but in the diner or whatever, or the bar, where they talk about apathy, which I brought up before.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like just such a, if there is a better exemplar of their worldviews, I don't know which scene it is. Like, you tell me, because that one is, I mean, they're almost just saying, I believe this, and this is who my character is. Like, that's basically what those scenes are, but it doesn't feel that way. It still feels very natural.
Yeah.
And man, God damn, is Morgan Freeman good in this?
Yes. Like,
Morgan Freeman falls into a kind of character, or a, what is it, a typecast, where he has a very specific way of talking, and he, you know, but some of these older 90s movies, like Shawshank, and like this, and different movies of this time, man, he had some serious like gumption and some attitude. Like, later he kind of becomes the soft-spoken, real sweet guy, you know what I mean? But it's like, man, he's like a fucking asshole in this. And, you know what I mean? Like I don't know. It's great. But real quick, because this kind of ties to what we're talking about. So another one of those themes, though, is that I wrote down was the human condition, where I think the film presents this really bleak and cynical view of humanity, yeah, even though 100%. The two protagonists kind of come from it a different direction. But it's really highlighting the darkness and depravity. How do I say this? That just kind of lurks beneath the surface of society, which is constantly being brought up to the surface because we're following two detectives that have to essentially find it. They have to bring it to the surface. So, you know, through its portrayal of the killer's twisted worldview, because we also haven't, we don't need to talk about it, but we also didn't even bring up as much the killer's worldview. So, so we actually have three completely different worldviews.
Yes.
If we want to go that far. But anyways, I digress. But yeah, so through the killer's twisted worldview or the horrific crimes that he commits, the film really tends to explore the depths of like human depravity, which is something that kind of kept going through my mind, and really just the capacity for evil within us all. And I don't think anything encapsulates that last thought more than the end of the film, we'll just stay with Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey, right?
Yeah.
Like this is the film kind of ends. You said it was like basically a bummer, fucked up endings or whatever. But like part of what makes it that though is because for all intents and purposes, and this is a light spoiler, I guess, but like the killer wins.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
100%. Yeah.
So really that human depravity, the capacity for evil within us all of those things kind of become highlighted through that. And I'm going to keep going, then I'm going to pass it off to you because I want your thoughts. Because I also want to talk about redemption and hopelessness, which we've also touched on. And I just want to get some more thoughts out on this because I was watching it and thinking about how despite the grim subject matter, Seven also just touches on these themes that it not only the themes that we've already discussed, but things like redemption, where it really... shines a light on it in a way that I really like, I guess. I don't know how else to say that right now. And also the search for meaning in what seems to be a hopeless world, which in that scene with the apathy and Somerset and Mills talking during that, that's a perfect example of that. So characters grapple with their own personal demons and struggles, and they search for a sense of purpose and redemption amidst the kind of chaos of what's going on. So again, Freeman's Detective Somerset often talks about that apathy, right? And he talks about how fucked up things are. And every time that Mills wants to do something, he goes, I mean, you can try, but I know it's not going to work. You know what I mean? So you have that, like, everything's hopeless, hopeless, hopeless. But then, like, Detective Mills attempts to make things better despite the hopelessness that he also sees. So it's like, it's not like he's ignoring it. It's not like he's stupid. No. Like you said, the worldviews. He just has two different worldviews that we're seeing. And his is like, despite the hopelessness, I'm going to redeem this place.
Yes.
One act at a time, right? And Somerset's given up. And he even admits when he's talking about apathy and judging people for being apathetic. And he's like, I am too. I'm not even judging people. I'm just saying this is true. Like, I'm not even saying I'm better, right? But also, Paltrow's Tracy, I think, introduces a little bit of both, actually. It's like she sees the hopelessness and is overwhelmed by it.
Yes.
But also has to find redemption in in this city and because of the pregnancy that she has. So like, dude, how fucking good is this, Joe?
Yeah. It is a lot.
Lot good.
I've been wanting to say for several minutes, but we kind of like bounce off the topic about Tracy. She's really the one representation of good in the film, like of real good. And she's the one that she sort of represents people in the city, right? Like these people who are just kind of swallowed up by the city. And that's kind of what she represents. She comes and she's, you know, and we mentioned she's the driving force between bringing the two of them together. And just among all of the cynicism and the bleakness and the hopelessness of this film, she's the one that's kind of consistently good. She's like the one beacon. And, you know, like you said, there's the scene where they have dinner and she's the one who gets him to open up. She gets, and also Mills is like, calmer when she's around. And then there's even the scene, and this is weird because this is such a relentlessly bleak movie, but there's a moment where she calls Somerset and it's very like secretive, and she's like, you know, can you meet me somewhere? You know, like I just need to talk. And it's like, in this movie, I'm like, what the hell is, like, is she about to have an affair with him? Like, what is going on? But it's not that, it's the opposite. She's like, I need your help. Like, I'm, you know, I'm pregnant. I don't know what to do. And she wants this guidance from him, from this guy who's like a fatherly figure. And,
but also the least fatherly figure ever.
Yes. Yes. And the advice he gives her is also kind of bleak, you know, and he says to her, he says, you know, he relates a story he had from someone who was not his wife, but to whom he was almost married, a woman he had a relationship with, and she got pregnant and he pressured her into getting an abortion. And he, and you can see the regret. He doesn't say I regret it, but you can see the regret on his face, because you can, it's easy for us as the viewer to just fill in the blanks that, you know, this was the end of their relationship, essentially, that he talked her into this. She did it. She resented him. She left him. And then here he is, worldview shaped, you know? So he said, listen, you have to decide what you want. If you want to get rid of this baby, if you want to get rid of this baby, don't ever tell him about it. And then he said, but if you do, and there's this moment when, and he like makes her cry, right? He says, if you do, if you do keep it, spoil that kid every chance you get. And it just like hits her.
Yeah. Breaks her.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just such a moment that is, you know, in a movie full of these big showy moments of death and destruction and, you know, horrific acts and cruelty. It's just kind of this oddly still a little bit bleak, but like the most hopeful bleak that you can have.
Yeah.
What, you know, that's an oxymoron if I've ever heard one, but it's, you know, it is still just has just that tiniest little glimmer of hope that, you know, and that's again what she represents. And, you know, we see how it turns out for her.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, I mean, you're right on all counts. And I think it's despite all of the evil that makes her kind of pop in those moments too. And that cry, when he makes her cry, that her performance there's so excellent.
Yeah.
Like what a moment for her. Like the way she breaks down is subtle, but also like just perfect. That is a moment I actually remember no matter how long I go without seeing the movie. Like that's one moment that stands out. I may not even remember what they were talking about when she started crying. I just remember her slumping down and like crying.
Yeah.
It's really great. I want to touch one thing that you just touched on as well. So we're just going to keep passing the baton here. But just the power of evil, which is pretty much displayed throughout the film. Cause Seven really emphasizes the insidious power of evil, I think, throughout the whole thing. The ability that it has to corrupt and destroy lives, which we see, exhibited at the end, or however you want to say, brought to life at the end of the film. Spoiler alert, I guess. The killer's meticulous planning, though, and the manipulation that he has serves as just like this really, I don't know, like it just reminds you of just the fucking darkness that exists, not only within humanity, but just like in the whole world that this movie takes place in, which is the real world. But it all, this feels like I'm too much of an I'm not an optimist in general. I always call myself a realist with optimistic tendencies. So whatever the optimistic part of that is brings me to believe, like, leads me to believe like this just isn't the whole world. This is a very specific world. Like I just can't, I don't want to live in a world where it's only this, but, but it's just a reminder of that darkness. Like I said, I think the film does that so well. And just the links that some will go to just fucking spread chaos and suffering. You touched on it perfectly. And this brings us to like the Kevin Spacey character. This is the last thing I have, and I'll pass it to you if you have anything else. But that scene where Kevin Spacey's in the back of the car and they're driving, and he thinks he's just outsmarting him the whole time.
Yeah.
But what's great is Somerset asks that question. that you asked earlier. Mm-hmm. And it kind of breaks him where he does just kind of give an, like, huh. And he contemplates it and then answers with like a sure or whatever you said, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But like, what I love about his character is he is reciting some internal manifesto that he's created over time to justify the natural feelings of chaos and suffering that he wants to like raise the world with. Right.
Yeah.
Like, and so I love that he talks this manifesto to them. And when Somerset finally asks him a simple question, or says something simple to him, right? He can't, that breaks the manifesto, right?
Yeah.
Fuck, man. That's so good. So I think beyond just like the production being great, the writing being great, the music, the performances being great, this being one of the greatest like detective serial killer or just detective thrillers, period, probably.
Sure, yeah.
And definitely top three, if not my favorite, David Fincher. I'd have to watch a couple others to get a new opinion on it. But right now, I just want to say that it is. But I also think it's those themes, that morality and sin and the justice and revenge, the human condition, the way that it handles redemption and hopelessness and the power of evil. I just realized this watching this movie that when I was younger, getting into film, I watched this movie and thought, oh, that's just a cool movie.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it wasn't Bergman. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Kubrick. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Hitchcock. It's just a fun movie. And then the more I watch it and the more I actually give in to what it's doing, I'm like, fuck, this is a good movie. And it's actually so badass beyond just being a fucking kick-ass movie.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to touch on before we move on?
Yeah, no, yeah. I want to even expand on what you were just saying. That,
good. Go for it.
You know, that you talk about the, you know, evil, and that again, that's just such a layered thing in this film, too. It's, you know, Kevin Spacey's character, John Doe, thinks that he's this holy figure. He's this, you know, he's this avenging angel, I guess, more or less, doing God's work, doing the good work of God. And he's also, you know, doing these horrific things. And he, you know, he references Sodom and Gomorrah at one point toward the end. And, you know, so he thinks that he is better than the rest of the world as it is, which he thinks is poisoned. But again, the duality part of that is that he is the poison also. You know, he's the poison that's making the world that way. And the police look at him that way, but also, you know, Mills particularly, well, I guess both of them in different ways, but they are also contributing to that, you know, to the negativity of the world, right? Like the world is a screwed up place. So did the world create John Doe? Is the world the source of the evil? Is God the source of evil? It's like, these are all questions that are raised either directly or kind of indirectly. And they, you know, that you, but you could pull from that if, you know, if you're writing a scholarly paper on this film, you can do that, you know, just by, you know, exploring these questions. So that's to me is really what makes this film just above and beyond, is that it's using these characters to just ask these really deep philosophical questions. And then it doesn't quite answer them, or does it? I don't know. It does, but also it doesn't. But it does that perfect thing, you know, that perfect, it's the perfect balance of, it's an entertaining movie that the masses can watch and love. And if you think about it a little more deeply, it also can stand with those Bergman films and, you know, those really like the old fashioned scholarly, you know, the movie that film professors love. It stands up with those because it asks those questions and it explores them in a really smart and insightful way. And it's just, you know, it's as close to a perfect movie, I think, as you'll get. I can't think of a movie that's more perfect than that film. You know, maybe there's a couple that approach it that are equal to it, but I can't think of one that's better as far as just doing everything it does in such a profound and above and beyond kind of way.
Yeah. I have nothing else to add to that because that was beautiful.
Five stars, watch again.
Ha 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 ha! everyone. Hopefully you enjoyed my conversation with Joe in the Medium Cool, the movie review, where we rewatch, movies that we've seen before, or at least that I really, it's centered around me. There might be some that Joe has or hasn't seen, but it's really like, hey, I want to rewatch these movies. I really want an updated opinion. And so, we watched 7 this time. I was actually, as I mentioned, able to watch it with a friend of mine who'd never seen it. So it's really fun to rewatch. But man, is that movie good? I want to take a moment and just talk about a few releases coming up this Friday so you can keep an eye out. This may not be in all theaters, and it may be even on a streaming network that you might or might not have. But at least you'll know what's coming out on April 5th, which is this coming Friday. We have the movie The First Omen. We have Monkey Man. Wicked Little Letters, which is will already have been out from the week before, but it expands to a wider release this weekend. So if you don't have it, if you didn't have it before, you might have it now. The Beast, Chicken for Linda. On Apple TV Plus, we have Girl State, The Greatest Hits in Theaters, Housekeeping for Beginners, Kim's Video, Parachute, The People's Joker, and on Netflix, we have Scoop. And if you're one of the lucky few that have Mubi, not a lot of people I know have it, but it is a really, really cool service. Yannick comes out. Do I know what half these are? Absolutely not. But now you can do what I'm going to do, and you can go look them up. So keep an eye out for those things. The ones that obviously are kind of bolded in my mind are The First Omen, Monkey Man, and Wicked Little Letters. Those are kind of the three bigger titles of any of those. But definitely go check those out and see how that goes. But hey, we're going to keep doing more of these movie reviews. Next week, we have Sam and Joe. We're going to talk about Being John Malkovich and James Cameron's The Abyss. So until next week, guys, I'm not drunk, I swear. Until next week, good night, good luck, and take it easy.